It's Wednesday, May 21st, 2008, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. Welcome to the Stash today. We've got plenty to talk about, but first, don't forget to call your Congress and tell them to support H.R. 5842 and H.R. 5843 to end the DEA raids in medical marijuana states and to legalize personal possession of marijuana. The number is 202-224-3121. Also, if you have a product that you'd like to market to the cannabis community, you can advertise on the Daily Audio Stash. Your ad will be focused on exactly the customer base you're seeking out, the thousands of responsible cannabis consumers who download and listen to this show. To advertise on the Daily Audio Stash, send us an email at stash@normal.org. Wednesday is Cannabis Science Day on the Stash, and coming up after the news, we're joined as always by Dr. Mitch Earlywine from the State University of New York at Albany. Dr. Mitch is here to debunk the latest reefer madness allegation out of Scotland that cannabis use leads to impotence, and also to discuss the trend toward increased student drug testing in America. Cannabis Carry brings us our musical break this Hemp Day Hump Day with the Hot Rocks and their song, Higher. Then we're back with Normal Deputy Director Paul Armentano with commentary on the sad news of Senator Ted Kennedy's recent diagnosis of a rare form of brain cancer called glioma, and the promising research that shows cannabis may be an effective treatment for glioma, research we cannot do in the United States because of prohibition. Don't forget also that it's not too late to enter our latest Pass the Stash contest. You could win a free DVD, autographed by AC/DC's Brian Johnson, of the new movie Totally Baked. Keep listening for details on how to win. So welcome to the show. Load up your silly little love bong and sit back with your favorite strain. This is your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Minnesota medical marijuana bill dies one step from governor. Yesterday, the Minnesota House of Representatives adjourned for the year without bringing up the medical marijuana bill, HF 655, for a vote on the House floor. The bill had passed the Senate at the beginning of the session and was endorsed by the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Minnesota AIDS Project, and the Minnesota Senior Federation, and thousands of doctors and nurses who endorsed the measure. Recent polling showed more than 2-to-1 public support in the state. However, a small but vocal group of law enforcement officials spread mistruths, exaggerations, and outright lies about the bill in an attempt to kill it, such as claiming that medical marijuana lacks support from the medical community and that medical marijuana laws increase teen use. In the end, the opposition's false claims swayed legislators enough to keep the vote from happening. And this is just another step in the battle. It's going to take many times, sometimes in these legislatures, to be able to get these bills through. Lawmakers are initially reluctant to support anything that has the word marijuana or cannabis in it, so we just have to keep on trying. Our thanks go out to all the people in Minnesota that helped to try to make this a reality, and we urge them to continue on and keep fighting the fight, and we'll be supporting you here at Normal. Washington Governor Gregoire rebuffs a 35-ounce in 60-day limit for medical marijuana possession. From the Seattle Times newspaper. A state health department proposal that medical marijuana patients be allowed more than 2 pounds of pot every 2 months took law enforcement by surprise and prompted the governor to tell health officials to start over. Faced with a legislative mandate to spell out what constitutes a 60-day supply by July 1st, the department in February briefed Governor Christine Gregoire's office on its recommendation. Patients or caregivers could possess up to 35 ounces of cultivated marijuana and be allowed a plant-growing area of 100 square feet. In 4 hearings around the state last fall, hundreds of patients and medical marijuana advocates lined up to speak. But conspicuously absent from most hearings were the voices of 2 important stakeholders, doctors and law enforcement officials. Officially, law enforcement leaders say they just want a number, any number, for the amount of pot qualified users can possess. They say they're not doctors and they wouldn't presume to set an amount any more than they would tell a patient how much cholesterol medication to take. But when pressed, they expressed discomfort with the amounts revealed to the governor in the briefing. Cowlitz County Sheriff Bill Mahoney says the whole issue is now, quote, very, very difficult for law enforcement to deal with, end quote, because nobody knows what constitutes a 60-day supply. Quote, from my standpoint as a sheriff, I just need the state to step up and define it. I don't care what the number is, end quote. But he adds, quote, most of the cops, if they were forced to come up with a number, they'd say 3 ounces, end quote. How did the State Department of Health calculate the amount? According to its briefing memo, obtained through a Public Disclosure Act request, the department began with the average dosages given to a handful of patients enrolled in a federal medical marijuana program. The federal program, called the Compassionate Investigational New Drug Program, supplies a limited number of patients with 300 to 450 joints per month, or about 9 ounces, according to department research. It doubled that amount because some patients might eat the marijuana instead of smoking it. The 35-ounce amount is more than permitted in some places that allow medicinal use, but less than others. For example, Oregon allows 24 ounces of usable marijuana and 6 mature plants, while limits in California counties and cities range from 8 ounces to 3 pounds in Humboldt, Santa Cruz, and Trinity counties, the health department's memo said. Yet Washington State's 60-day supply law is in real need of definition. I know when I first moved to Oregon, I thought that 3 ounces was a whole lot of cannabis. And for a recreational user or someone suffering only from occasional pain or nausea, it is a lot of cannabis. But I know patients who cannot smoke or vaporize, they must eat their medicine. Patients who are suffering so severely that the same 3 ounces that might last you months may only last them a few days. And we can never forget that marijuana is a crop. You don't always get a guaranteed good harvest. A large possession limit allows a patient to stockpile in case of a failed crop. This strange legislative dance between patients who need to grow medicine and police who need to catch potheads is always going to create these ludicrous situations where medical decisions must be tempered by the whims of stakeholders in law enforcement. This is why cannabis needs to be legal for all adults. Otherwise, patients will always suffer from non-medical limits, mistaken raids, and black market prices. Oregon hospitals also denying transplants to medical marijuana patients. From the Willamette Week. Tim Guerin, a 56-year-old professional musician who had hepatitis C, died after a University of Washington Medical Center committee denied him a spot on a liver transplant list. Part of their reason? Guerin used medical marijuana, which is legal under Washington law. Guerin wouldn't have fared any better in Oregon, where medical marijuana has been legal since 1999. Hospitals here refuse to perform transplants on patients who treat their severe pain, nausea, and other symptoms under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. the state's largest transplant program, run jointly by the Oregon Health Sciences University and the Portland VA Medical Center, turns away patients who use marijuana. Legacy Health Systems also performs kidney transplants and refuses marijuana users. Those are the only two transplant programs in the state, leaving Oregon's medical marijuana patients completely out in the cold. It's impossible to say anyone died just because they didn't get a transplant, but at least 30 Oregonians who use medical marijuana have died in the past 10 years after hospitals denied them new organs, says Paul Stanford, head of the THC Foundation, a chain of medical marijuana clinics based in Oregon. Madeline Martinez, head of the Oregon branch of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, says, quote, "It's a death sentence. Most of the people have already expired because they didn't have the transplant," end quote. Those affected include Jim Clar, a 56-year-old professional musician from Brookings. He suffers from cirrhosis and hepatitis C and quit taking medical marijuana in 2004 to qualify for a new liver. Meanwhile, he lives with crippling nausea that used to vanish with a single puff of smoke. Clar, who sits on the 11-member State Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, says, quote, "I've capitulated because basically I don't have much of a choice," end quote. OHSU doctors also bar marijuana users because of medical concerns, including a higher risk of infection and pulmonary problems. Users of other illegal drugs, drinkers, and even tobacco smokers are also barred from getting transplants, but anyone can join once they pass a drug test and meet other requirements. Dr. William Bennett, head of kidney transplants at Legacy, says those are the same reasons his program bars marijuana users. He also says patients on mind-altering drugs are less likely to stick with their treatment in the long run, leading to a higher rate of transplant failure. It amazes me when I read these quotes from medical professionals that are so ignorant about cannabis. Take that one line. Users of other illegal drugs, drinkers, and even tobacco smokers are also barred from getting transplants. Why? Because those medical marijuana patients are just more illegal drug users? Because they're just people looking to get high recreationally, like smokers and drinkers? How about the line, anyone can join once they pass a drug test? Well, what other legal doctor-recommended medicines will you be testing for? Lipitor? Xanax? OxyContin? Percocet? Viagra? No. You'll be testing for coke, meth, heroin, and, of course, marijuana. How about, patients on mind-altering drugs are less likely to stick with their treatment? What? You don't think OxyContin is mind-altering? Have you ever listened to Rush Limbaugh? Or this one, risk of infection and pulmonary problems. Once again, cannabis can be grown organically and taken orally or in vapor form. No infections or no lung problems to speak of. They can wrap it up in as many excuses as they want, but these transplant programs simply want to discriminate against cannabis because they have a moral issue with cannabis.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
Hey, hey, who found the law?
Okay, for our latest Pass the Stash contest, you could win the uncensored DVD of Totally Baked, written by Craig Shoemaker and autographed by the executive producer Brian Johnson, the lead singer of AC/DC. It's a hilarious story of two medical marijuana activists who hide out in the home of a straight-laced dad and take him and his debate team friends hostage. While the activists employ creative strategies to convince the squares on the truth about cannabis, a Rod Serling-esque narrator, Shoemaker, weaves us through commercials, stand-up, documentary interviews, and skits that are interspersed throughout the movie. All you have to do to win your autographed copy is to send me an email at stash@normal.org. All I want to know is your funniest first-time pot-smoking story. Now, limit your story to 420 words or less and send it in now. This contest only lasts 2 weeks. The winner will be announced May 30th. By submitting a story, you agree to have it published on the Stash blog and read on the air, but we will be glad to change names and identifying details to keep you anonymous. So send in your funny 420 story today and win your autographed free copy of Totally Baked DVD. And thanks for playing Pass the Stash. Well, if it's Wednesday, it's hump day. And if it's hump day, that means we're going to be visiting with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who's an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany. Dr. Earlywine, welcome back to the Stash.
Hey, it's splendid to be on the show.
Hey, I'm glad I've got you here because, you know, we always like to bring you here to the Stash to give people the honest scientific facts behind marijuana and the studies that come out. And there's so many of these reefer madness stories that we have to deal with. And a lot of them seem to be coming from the UK. And I just wanted to get your take on this latest one. I posted on this yesterday about the doctors in Scotland blaming the rise on spending on Viagra on cannabis, saying that more teenage boys and men under 40 are getting Viagra because the dreaded reefers are causing impotence. Is there any sort of medical evidence of that?
Isn't this hilarious how quickly they can jump to this when literally just a few years ago we were hearing about marijuana turning you into a sex fiend?
Yeah.
So it's clearly the most magical drug in the world if it can both turn you into a sex fiend and prevent you from getting an erection. I think what's happened here is maybe a couple of cases where folks under 40 have asked for Viagra and happen to have used cannabis have been very salient in certain physicians' minds, and they tend to see things that are consistent with their biases. So once you see something, you tend to remember the stuff that fits you, so all the other stereotypes that show up in the world, we seem to remember selectively. And then once you really take a good look at the data, you find, no, that correlation's not there at all. The idea that cannabis would be contributing to this isn't pharmacologically impossible, I mean, because there is some vasoconstriction associated with the inhalation of smoke, but it would certainly seem like tobacco, alcohol, other contributors to heart disease, all these other things would be much more likely candidates, particularly in Scotland, where, I hate to say it, but the average drinker there would put most drinkers here right under the table. But also the idea that folks under a certain age are requesting Viagra actually because they have erectile dysfunction. I'm afraid to say it, but at least when I was on the West Coast, this was more something folks did to get that fourth and fifth erection of the day rather than because they were having a problem getting the first one.
Yeah, that's something I had, you know, wanted to take into account here is the use of Viagra as a recreational drug rather than a treatment for ED.
And in fact, you know, the way Viagra works, it's essentially inhibiting something that's preventing all the blood from flowing down there. And the combination with marijuana probably isn't a great idea, as I've mentioned both in my High Times column and in other places. And in truth, if you're paying good attention to how you feel and what's going on, if you're not getting an erection, odds are high there's a reason, and it's a fine reason. And you can explain to your partner that you're having a good time and that this just isn't what's up right now, so to speak. But the bottom line really is that I think it's extremely unlikely, given how frequently folks use cannabis and the base rate of erectile dysfunction in folks at this young age, that there's any variation here at all.
Right. And part of the article here, the doctors had said something about the number of patients being prescribed Viagra is climbing 20% a year in some areas. Wouldn't you have to have a 20% climb in cannabis to kind of even come close to making that claim?
Well, and of course that would be a pretty preposterous, but even if there was just a 1% increase in cannabis use, that wouldn't, you know, necessarily mean that these things covary in a way that's at all causal. It could very much mean that folks who happen to like recreational drugs of any sort happen to like other drugs for recreational purposes as well.
Yeah, I just think it didn't take into account the idea of people, especially younger people, taking it as an enhancement rather than a treatment. And then, of course, you know, you kind of also mentioned the lifestyle choices. People are more sedentary. Younger people play more video games. They don't get up as much. Bad diets. All of this could be contributing factors in this Viagra prescription.
Well, and in truth, once they've got even some decent correlational data, I'd be willing to entertain at least some alternative explanation for this. But this is just a couple of physicians talking about some observations. And again, we tend to confirm our stereotypes whenever we look out and don't take systematic views of the world.
Well, let's go a little bit meta on this about, you know, just the coverage itself. Like you said, it's just a couple of doctors here in Scotland, you know, not any sort of study, not any sort of scientific background behind this theory of theirs. How is it that the media always brings this to our attention, these little tiny nothing, you know, rants about marijuana that are bad, and yet we'll put together a study that shows the great results with, say, multiple sclerosis or treating cancer or whatever, and it gets barely a mention in the back pages of the newspaper?
Well, it's particularly suspicious given the recent change in classification in the UK, and here we are in Scotland where, you know, those laws are taken into effect. I understand the desire to decrease teen use in any honest way possible, but this is clearly something that's going to become laughable to anybody under a certain age who thinks that this is some kind of effort to minimize their cannabis use. And I hate to say it, it's another one of those situations where we really lose credibility. So underage smokers, you know, folks we don't want to see using cannabis, are going to see something like this, think it's a lie, and then later on, when we have something really important to say about, say, methamphetamine or drugs that are, you know, truly dangerous, they're not going to believe that because we cried wolf in these situations.
Right, right. And let's turn this the other direction, to coin a phrase, I suppose. Is there any sort of reports or studies showing any sort of aphrodisiac benefits of cannabis, that cannabis might actually replace the Viagra in some circumstances? Is there anything to that?
I can imagine there's not a lot of research funding on those kinds of topics.
I'll volunteer.
Yeah, exactly. Calicus and some other researchers in the 70s and 80s have found consistent reports, but only self-reports, of enhanced orgasm, appreciation of your partner, and things along those lines. They didn't ask directly about, you know, can you get it up, but it certainly sort of was implied with this. And, you know, anecdotal evidence is pretty profound on this topic. Obviously, it's going to be a long time before we have funding to bring folks in the lab and actually get to demonstrate this. But I feel like the numbers and the effusiveness of these reports is so overwhelming that it's really hard to dispute.
Well, research funders out there, if you're listening to The Stash, you can send in your funding to stash@normal.org. I'll be glad to take it all and put together a crack study here of the effects of cannabis and sex. We'll see what we can do.
Repeated measures, single sample, yeah.
Well, let's get serious again here. You were talking about teenagers and what they're going to believe or not believe. Of course, everybody's always working to try to keep kids off of cannabis. And the latest salvo from the drug warriors here in this arena has been drug testing in the schools. We just recently got some reports on the increase in drug testing in the, you know, even down to elementary schools. And I thought I'd get some of your thoughts on that as to the effectiveness of this, or what's going to be the result from this increase in drug testing.
I'm really flabbergasted by this move. When Pot Politics came out, my student Sarah Smucker Barnwell did a great review of drug testing in the workplace, basically showing that the drug testing doesn't seem to alter drug use in any way, and in fact seems to cost more than it earns and creates this kind of bad atmosphere in the workplace. Now we have data, particularly from really large studies done through Michigan, where surveys show that students who are at schools where there is drug testing are no less likely to use drugs than at schools where there is no such drug testing. So this isn't going to create the result that folks seem to want. And then on top of it, you have all this crazy, you know, ridiculous environmental attitude, if you will, where suddenly students are perceived as potential lawbreakers, as they are the enemy, that they have to do these cumbersome urine screens in situations that make things really difficult with their teachers or whoever's in charge of doing the urine screens, and at incredible expense, when in fact it's also designed to get folks from participating in extracurriculars. So in order to be in an extracurricular, you have to take a drug test. What is one of the best buffers against drug problems in school? Well, it's participation in extracurriculars. Mm. So the folks we want to reach the most and get them involved in alternative activities are the ones who are now going to decline those opportunities because they don't want to be drug tested.
Yeah, it reminds me of the movie Dazed and Confused when the character Pink, you know, the quarterback, is they demand a drug test of him and he refuses to go out for the team because of it. This is going to happen over and over in schools all across the country. You're just going to turn off a certain segment of the population that could most use those extracurricular activities.
The funny thing about it, too, is for the price, there are wonderful drug prevention programs that they could do. I'm happy to fly anywhere and walk through everything in Parents Guide to Marijuana for any of these schools. It's really out there. Some of the data from Steve Sussman's lab at University of Southern California, Marianne Pence. We've got folks in San Francisco with wonderful drug prevention programs that don't require anybody's pee and that would be as, you know, equally expensive or less than these programs, and they don't have that invasion of privacy, all these problems with constitutionality of this, and what a surprise, it might actually decrease drug problems, whereas this, clearly the data suggests, it doesn't alter use in any way meaningful.
Now, the only thing they're accomplishing through these student drug testing programs, it's a feel-good measure for, you know, a nothing sort of feel-good measure for people to think that they're doing something about it when, like you point out, they're wasting money, time, and maybe even making the situation worse.
The irony is, even just since this article came out about increases in testing, I'm getting more emails about how to pass drug tests.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just really apprehensive that this is going to turn into this crazy two-headed monster of drug testing companies and counter-drug testing companies battling it out, trying to create ways of, you know, basically detecting each other, and essentially all this money is literally going down the drain.
Now, we're seeing it in the workplace for certain. I've had a human resources person tell me one time that the drug test wasn't so much to test if you were on drugs, it was test to see if you were smart enough to pass a drug test.
Oh, that's intriguing.
So I guess the idea being that, you know, they know people use marijuana, they know people use drugs. If it's so out of control that you can't quit for 2 weeks or whatever it takes to flush out, that's really what they're searching for. It's again a method of controlling people, and it's just very, very frustrating to hear about.
Well, and I'm all for, if people are messing up at school, if students have a bunch of D's, if they're people who are at work who just aren't doing the job, by all means, recommend some kind of remediation for them. But let's base it on a performance, not on the content of your pee.
Right, based on performance. And it's like that court case that went down in Washington State, just north of me, where the presiding judge who had ruled that drug testing all students was unconstitutional under Washington state law, she said that if you can't tell there's a drug problem to be solved, there's no need to test. And if you have to test to find if there's a drug problem, then you don't have enough problem. It's kind of a circular argument there.
Well, but it's beautifully put. Cliff Schaefer, a fan of many, has pointed out that there was a time when, you know, people couldn't be discriminated against because of their color or their skin. Now perhaps we can take another step and say you won't be discriminated against because of what's in your urine.
The content of the urine, absolutely. Well, Dr. Earlywine, thanks for joining us here on our Cannabis Science Day. It's always good to talk to you and get the latest information with the real facts behind it.
Oh, it's stellar being on the show. Thanks.
Hello, Hello, I'm Casper Leach, host of Time for Hemp. When our politicians passed the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937, the citizens of the United States had no idea that a new civil war had begun. Now, after more than 7 decades of this war's escalation and spending well over $1 trillion of taxpayers' money, the result has been an arrest record of more than 37 million brothers and sisters for nonviolent drug offenses. Every year, we choose to continue this war. We do so at the cost of well over $69 billion. Add to this, we are building prisons faster than we are building schools. In fact, the prison industry is now one of the fastest growing industries in the United States. We must end this civil war. We can with your help. Please, join LEAP, the law enforcement against prohibition, and become part of the solution to ending the war on drugs. Go to leap.cc and find out how to become a member.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Well, happy hump day on the Stash. We're serving up some rock and roll to ease your mind this week. The Hot Rocks bring us today's musical track, Higher, a southern rock and roll gem with heartfelt lyrics and an infectious beat. This is good old rock, and I'd expect nothing less from a group that has Rocks in their band name and is led by a frontman named Eric Rocks. Rounding out this Tennessee four-piece is The Chad on guitar, Topher on bass, and Jason Steve the Pirate Hess on drums. There's got to be a good story in those names there. The band members found each other in Nashville, the heart of American music. Let the Hot Rocks take you higher today. Visit their webpage, thehotrocks.com, to learn more and download their brand of Southern Fried Rock. You can also get more information on the Hot Rocks at our website at stash.normal.org, where we also have an MP3 download of today's song. It's The Hot Rocks with Higher.
Yeah. Just say no.
No matter what you call it, it's a huge part of popular culture.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
You don't need weed school. You just need a copy of the new book, Pot Culture, The A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life.
Hey, this is great, man.
Even if you never smoked marijuana.
I never used marijuana. Sorry.
Don't think you smoked marijuana.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and didn't inhale.
Or you used to smoke marijuana.
I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Pot Culture by former High Times editor Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin will answer every question you ever had about marijuana culture.
Has that marijuana made it back up here yet?
Check out Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life at Amazon.com or visit PotCultureBook.com today.
Too bad, man. I just stopped smoking yesterday.
Well, twice in 1 week, it's not always that we get Paul Armentano, our deputy director from Normal, on the show, but the news of the day kind of dictates that we do. And so, Paul, welcome back to the Daily Audio Stash.
Good to be here talking to you, Russ.
Well, it's unfortunate news that kind of brings us here, of course. People have probably already heard now the unfortunate news about Senator Ted Kennedy from the state of Massachusetts, age 76, who has just recently had a seizure this weekend and has now been diagnosed with a type of brain cancer. And Paul brought this up on the Normal blog, and I thought it deserved some attention here, about the possibility of the use of cannabis and cannabinoids in the treatment of these types of brain cancer. So Paul, let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, what is this type of brain cancer that Senator Kennedy has?
Well, according to the news report, they said he was diagnosed with glioma. Glioma is essentially an all-encompassing term to refer to a particular types of brain cancer. You know, the short of this is it's really quite tragic. There are some types of gliomas that are slightly more aggressive than others, but the bottom line is the New York Times and some other outlets have reported, you know, about 50% of individuals diagnosed with gliomas, they pass away within 1 year, and really almost all of them pass away within 3 years, and that is even with the standard treatments available, which in this case are typically radiation or chemotherapy. Unfortunately, these types of cancers of the brain are typically so aggressive that by time they're diagnosed, they've really taken such a foothold that there isn't much treatment that can be given. And these are also cancers that often reoccur even if radiation and chemotherapy are somewhat successful. So this is really, you know, sad news to hear.
Now, the part there where we come in has to do with some of the research that's been done specifically with regard to using cannabis, THC, marijuana, whatever, in the treatment of cancer. And specifically, we brought up some video from yourself and Dr. Behrman down at the clinical conference in California discussing about the latest studies from Dr. Guzman and other doctors. So let's tell people a little bit about that and what hope there might be for cannabis as a therapy here.
Dr. Behrman and I just ironically were talking about the research that is available looking at the potential to use components in marijuana as anti-cancer agents. For about 35 years or so, believe it or not, there have been investigators that have been testing whether the administration of certain constituents in marijuana, specifically THC, but CBD as well, could actually halt the progression of certain malignant cancerous tumors. And it would probably surprise, you know, many people listening to know that as far back as a study that was published in 1975 that was actually conducted in Virginia found, you know, 34, 35 years ago, that when you administer doses of cannabinoids in lab rats that suffer from different types of malignant tumors, in this case, lung tumors were being tested, you actually see that the rats that have been treated, the tumors do not spread the way they do in animals that aren't treated, and you see an increase in survival in these animals. This was known and acknowledged, you know, as I said, you know, 34, 35 years ago. Unfortunately, almost since the publication of that study, there has been no follow-up work done in the United States to look at whether cannabis or cannabinoids can be a potential anti-cancer agent. Fortunately, there have been researchers, predominantly researchers in Israel, Spain, and Italy, who really over the last decade have published now several dozen papers looking at treating cancers with compounds in marijuana. In particular, they have looked at these brain cancers, these gliomas, and they have found really two remarkable things happen when cannabinoids are administered to animals suffering from glioma. Either A, the cannabinoids seem to target the malignant cells and kill those cells while leaving the surrounding cells healthy, and they also see that cannabinoids tend to cut off the blood supply to these tumors so that they cannot proliferate the way they would otherwise. Two really amazing results. It's just unfortunate that this research is taking place overseas and not taking place in this country.
And that's pretty much the magic bullet of cancer research, because the treatments now, of course, are, sure, we'll kill the cancer cells and we'll kill damn near every other cell in your body while we're doing it. So the idea that we could target those cells themselves and leave the rest of the cells healthy, that sounds like such an incredible breakthrough. So is it fair to say that the United States government at the very least is ignoring this research, or are they actively trying to suppress this type of research and understanding?
Well, you'd have to ask them. I mean, certainly they've ignored their own research going on three decades now. And it's, as I said, it's been up to scientists in other parts of the world to pick up where these American researchers left off in 1974 and 1975. You know, most interesting to me is that there was a pilot study published in 2006 where they actually injected THC into the cancerous tumors in the brain of 9 human subjects who were suffering from glioblastoma. And what they found was that in 2 of those subjects, they experienced a reduction in the proliferation of these cancerous tumors in the brain. To my knowledge, that is the only human trial that is available that has actually assessed whether the use of cannabinoids can reduce human brain cancers in patients. And I certainly would like to see some follow-up work done in this area.
Well, it certainly is some amazing, amazing scientific news to find this out. And we want to stress to everyone that nobody's here trying to claim that marijuana is the snake oil cure-all for everything. But certainly this type of research shows that there is promise in the use of cannabis and cannabis therapies for the treatment of some of these cancers. It really deserves more legitimate research. And we've got to end adult marijuana prohibition so that we can get these solutions out to the people that desperately need them. It shouldn't take a senator, unfortunately, being stricken with this for us to raise the issue. But if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes. It's something we need to make a change here in our policy.
Sure, and I want to be clear here to people listening. You know, none of these studies, and you can now read about a litany of them if you go to Normal's front page and look at the blog in the upcoming days, or if you go to my booklet, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis. You know, none of these studies has assessed whether an individual smoking marijuana will see a reduction in the proliferation of cancer. These are all either preclinical trials that dealt with lab animals, or as I said, there is one human clinical trial, but in all of these cases, the cannabinoids were actually administered straight to the tumor. There was no inhalation taking place.
Right.
So it would be very hard from that data, if one could even do it at all, to extrapolate whether, you know, this other route of administration, inhaling cannabis the way, you know, so many people actually use it would have the same effect. But it certainly does bear repeating that when cannabinoids are administered directly to these cancerous tumors or to these cancerous cells, they seem to have a dramatic effect at targeting and killing cancerous cells. And not just for brain cancers, but for a whole host of cancers, whether it's lung cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, lymphoma. There's really quite a long list.
You know, I just can't help but think that had they discovered in 1975 some previously unknown plant that had these sort of effects, they'd have funded this research to the hilt and we'd have cured cancer by now. But because it's called marijuana, nobody can get their minds past the reefer madness lies, and we continue to be prohibited from doing legitimate research. It's just such a shame.
It really is, particularly when we see some of the progress that Manuel Guzman, a researcher in this area from Spain, and his research team has made literally just in the past 4 or 5 years, to think that, quite frankly, for the last 35 years, scientists could have been doing research in this area, but weren't and did not, simply because the drug in question was a component of marijuana. You know, it's really a shame we have to sit here and play what if, and it's certainly far more of a shame, it's tragic, that for the families over the years that have lost loved ones to this terrible disease, that they also have to ask what if.
It is a shame, but we'll keep fighting. We're going to hope for the best for Senator Kennedy and anyone else out there suffering from all these different forms of cancer. And here at Normal, we'll continue to fight to end adult marijuana prohibition so the research can continue and maybe save some lives. Paul Armentano is the deputy director of Normal and the author of the Clinical Applications for Cannabis pamphlet that you can get online at normal.org to answer all your questions about the research. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave today with a cannabis quote from Emily Murphy, a Canadian prohibitionist from 1923. Check out this reefer madness. Quote, "While in this condition, high on marijuana, they became raving maniacs and are liable to kill or indulge in any form of violence to other persons, using the most savage methods of cruelty without, as said before, any sense of moral responsibility. If this drug is indulged to in any great extent, it ends in the untimely death of its addict." End quote. Well, that's all we got for the stash today. I hope you excuse me. I have to go become a raving maniac for a little while. Take care of each other, tokers.